Welcome to the final Phillips Hour of this series of interviews. I'm Roger Phillips, and today we're hearing from two women. One, a senior member of the clergy at Liverpool Cathedral, who's once an actor and has a PhD in music hall, but first a physician, global health researcher, teacher and mother. Dr. Angela Abbasi works at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, but she wasn't born here.
I was born in Blackburn in Lancashire, which Beatles fans may recognise from the Holes. Bizarrely, I was always somehow linked to Liverpool and Merseyside.
And your parents were Nigerian?
Both my parents are from Imo State, which is in southeast Nigeria. My father came to Blackburn because at that time, if you think back, Lancashire was the centre really of the textile industry, and he was an industrial chemist. Mm. And all the people from his village came together to put the resources together to get him over here.
That's amazing. I'll tell you what I do think. There are people who are, sort of see Africa as one place and don't know much about anything would be very surprised to hear about your dad being so clever and being educated in that way.
You know, there are people who study migration and study immigration, and, you know, they are better placed than me to speak about it. But there is a whole history of people, highly educated people from different parts of the world coming to European countries for the purposes of education, contributing their knowledge and their skills and taking that knowledge back to their countries of origin. You know, my father, I mean, he died, unfortunately, last year, and he's one of the most intelligent men that I've ever known.
Now, what about your mother? Did she work as well? And did they meet here or in Nigeria?
No, they were married in Nigeria before they came, and she was a teacher but couldn't get a job teaching when she came here. So she became a carer and worked in for many, many years in one of those large, do you remember those large sink mental health institutions?
I do.
That's what she did. She did that at home and at work.
Yeah, it was quite a big household to care for, wasn't it?
I have four siblings, so there's five of us all together. With both parents working. I mean, I only have two children myself, and I often remark on how amazing the feat is that she achieved. I mean, how you raise five children, especially then, without so many of the modern conveniences that we have now. I mean, it just beggars belief, really.
What interests me about your siblings is that the girls were given, in inverted commas, English names, whereas I take it the... I will pronounce this wrongly.
You know, so we were brought up as Catholics. My parents were both Catholics, and so we were all given slightly religious but slightly biblical names. But we all have Nigerian middle names. And one of my sisters and my brother use their Nigerian names.
I regret to say I do not know what the language is in that particular state in Nigeria. But did you speak that language at home as well as English?
Yeah, so yeah, we had a combination of the two, really. But as time went on, we all kind of increasingly favoured the English language, just because that's the language that our friends and spoke, and that's what we spoke at school. But I think that there's a lot of individuals from immigrant backgrounds who are bilingual, and that's a real skill. You know, I wish my Igbo was better than it is.
Your children themselves, did they speak any Igbo or not?
No, we just don't have facility at home, really. You know, I think if you're going to be bilingual, then the language has to be spoken by both parents all the time.
And, yes, you're right.
That wasn't possible.
Now, where did you go to primary school? In Blackburn?
Oh, all my entire education was in Blackburn. And I look back on it now, and, you know, they did a really good job. You know, I was very fortunate. At the time that I was at school, there were not so many Black African or even Black Caribbean families. So, in a way, we were spared some of the worst elements of discrimination that you hear about. And I was allowed just to be me. I feel like I had phenomenal support and encouragement at my schools. You know, I went to a series of schools where I was the only Black girl in the year that I was in. And in one of my schools, I think I was only the second Black girl that had ever gone there. I often feel that if we'd have been brought up in, you know, in Manchester or London, where the stereotypes were much more widely disseminated and some of the prejudices might have been more deeply ingrained, then I might not have had the opportunities that I did. But, you know, in the schools that I went to, I had wonderful supportive teachers. You know, I ended up being deputy head girl in one school and head girl in another school, and I just was allowed to thrive. I feel really grateful for that.
I'm surprised you're saying you didn't experience any racism, especially if you're the...
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying, you know, so in Blackburn, if you remember, the National Front had a really strong presence in the Northwest. You know, these things ebb and flow, don't they? And with every new wave of extremism, you find that there are pockets. And I remember very clearly having a brick thrown through our window I think I would have still been in primary school at that stage. You're probably old enough to remember the series Roots when it was on television.
Yes.
And whilst it was wonderful that story of the strength and the power of those slaves were, in a way, that series celebrated something that hadn't been celebrated before. The overall story is one of contemptible exploitation and cruelty. There is a underlying story of strength and resistance and redemption, and the strength of the characters within that series captured not just imaginations in England. I think it was a global success.
Yes, it was.
One of the downsides of that was that, you know, suddenly there were new names that you could be called. And so I remember being called Kizzy, you know, many, many times. You remember she was one of the female protagonists in that story. That was on the streets, that was kind of outside. In school, you know, I was allowed to be clever. I was encouraged to be bright. I was trusted to do well, and I was really supported at that time.
Were you ambitious?
Well, see, ambition is one of those things, isn't it? Ambition, when you hear the word ambition, you think about power and self-aggrandizement. From a very young age, when I was 4 or 5, apparently, I said, I'm going to be a doctor and I'm going to work for the World Health Organization.
Really?
To me, that's not about ambition. It's kind of more about purpose. And I feel that I've always had that. I've always had that sense of purpose. I've always had that belief that the world can be made better. People can be made well. And I've always had that strong sense of responsibility to contribute to that in whatever way that I could. We had a doctor, Dr. Sutherland, but he was a wonderful, wonderful GP, a very caring man who, you know, when you're a child, you know, these people, doctors, can be very intimidating, can't they? They can be very, you know, it can be a scary experience. And he always was at pains to make me feel, you know, safe. And he spoke to me like I was an adult. He didn't speak to me like I was a child. And he, just as an ordinary town GP, he was really, I feel, instrumental in making me think, actually, do you know what? I want to do what he does. I want to make people better.
So where did you train?
So I trained in King's College. And again, I feel I had a phenomenal clinical training there. The preclinical was, at that time, the way medical training worked was that you spent, you know, a couple of years book learning theory, you know, biochemistry, anatomy. And then once you've done all your book learning, you're then placed in hospital to do your clinical training. And I think the two things that I'm really pleased about, or I think I really benefited from in relation to King's, was that it wasn't just a medical school. You could have gone to a number of places where you'd have just been amongst medics, whereas King's was a university. So while I was in preclinical and in the theory phase, I was able to make friends with lawyers and historians. And, you know, I had the opportunity to mix with a whole range of people. And if you can imagine, I was the youngest in the year when I went, you know, from a girl from Blackburn to go down to London and to be mixing with this phenomenal range of people. That was a great, great opportunity. Secondly, once we got to clinical, we did our clinical at King's College Hospital in Camberwell, is a really dense inner city population that's very multicultural. And so again, you know, the opportunity to get exposure to the whole range of not just diseases, but personality types. Because I think a lot of being a doctor is about being able to speak to human beings, and you get practice at speaking to a whole range of people. And these are things that I hadn't really understood when I was filling out my UCCA form. Do you remember that phrase?
Yeah. UCCA,
and I, you know, these are things that I only had a vague sense of. So I was very, very lucky in the choice of hospital that I had.
Wasn't the important thing, or one of the important things, and it's influenced your career since, is that HIV was prevalent at that time. People were dying.
After my initial training, once I got my basic qualification, you go through the junior doctor role, and HIV was taking off. Time. And I think I've already said to you that I was already interested in global health. I was interested in health outside of England. The impact of the HIV epidemic in Africa in particular just, you know, captured everybody's imagination. One of the things I wanted to learn was tropical medicine. And one of the most important tropical diseases was HIV at that time. So that was the training that I was doing. And I was providing care for HIV positive people in London. And it just became clear that actually what needs to happen is people need to just not get it. People need to not get the infection in the first place. And I became increasingly fascinated about how you can prevent it. You know, that felt like, you know, with my one life, that this is, my energies are better spent working on prevention. And so through some consultants that were there, in particular a guy called Professor David Mabey, who's at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, I worked with him and a guy called Richard Hayes, and I got an MRC fellowship.
Medical Research Council,
Medical Research Council, and went out to Tanzania and did exactly that. Worked on a project that looked into preventing HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases amongst adolescents. And, you know, from there, that's just one of those formative experiences that you just never look back. That turned me into a global health researcher.
How did you end up? You'd have thought you'd have done all this down in London, but you've ended up here at Liverpool School.
Yeah, well, there aren't that many places that you can do global health in the world. And I when I came back from my fellowship, you know, the job came up in Liverpool, and it's quite bizarre, actually. A really good friend of mine who was working in Glasgow at the time, a woman called Julie Clegg, sent me the Guardian advert for the job here in Liverpool. And I was really happy in London at that point. I wasn't really looking to move. You know, I'd just finished my fellowship. I was just getting, you know, my feet back under the table in England. I'd just bought a flat. And at the same time, a really good friend in London saw the same advert in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ. You know, with these two people who knew me very well, you know, coming to say, look, Angela, we feel this is the job for you. And I kind of spoke to a number of people, and my mentor at the time, a guy called Mike Adler, who really did a lot of pioneering work in terms of raising the profile of HIV and its importance and the need for a public health approach. And he sat me down and said, Angela, you know, you just need to, this is a grown-up job, you need to go and do this job. And, you know, with that kind of, you know, I think sometimes a lot of us in our careers don't see our potential. And sometimes you need other people from outside to say, you can do this. And I came and saw the city. I knew Liverpool, obviously, because my really good friend at the time, medical school was from Liverpool, so I've been to Liverpool many times before. Again, another Beatles connection, his mum, a lovely woman called Marie Crawford, Ringo Starr, often refers to her as the woman who taught him how to read. So Liverpool was a city that I had a lot of affection for anyway. And I came and I looked around the institution, and the director at the School of Tropical Medicine at Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine at that time, a woman called Janet Hemingway, had just secured some funding to expand the school. And I was taken to meet her, and she had the plans for the building that a lot of people will now be very familiar with on Pembroke Place. She had the plans laid out on her desk, and she said, I've got some of the money for this now, I'm halfway there, and I just need to secure, I think at that time it was another couple of million, I can't remember exactly, but I was really captured by her energy, and this was a place that's going places, you know, this is an enterprise that I really want to be part of. And sure enough, you know, the CTI building is up. I can see it from my window. And, you know, I'm now sitting in another building opposite the CTID building that's been put up since then. The institution has really grown over the last 10 years, and it's been really wonderful to see.
You spent 4 years at some point in Tanzania.
Yeah, so that was my fellowship. So that was when I was still in London, and that was the MRC fellowship that I spoke to you about. And that was my first experience of running, you know, a large piece of a research program, and it was tremendous. And I still work in Tanzania, and it's a country that, you know, I hope to continue to work in, you know, until the end of my career. It's a beautiful country filled with beautiful people. Developed over the years some really important personal and professional relationships, and there's a real privilege, really, I think, in being able to work with other people who care about the health of a country in the same way that you do. And I think that's one of the gifts, I think, of global health is the opportunity to just engage with people who have that perspective, who have that national perspective in their approach to problems. I feel I've been very fortunate in that I've been able to combine that clinical one-to-one relationship of being a doctor where an individual human being comes to you with a problem, and you know, you work with them to solve that problem on an individual level. And then separately, once my clinical day is over, I then go back to thinking about problems on a population level and work with teams of people to address the research questions that are challenging the health in the African countries that I've been working with. It has been an extraordinary privilege, really.
You talk about Tanzania, but it's a particular place, isn't it, Mwanza? Because I know you raise money for a care home and an orphanage there.
Yeah, so I lived in Mwanza for 4 years, and you know, you develop relationships, and we while I was living there, we did some fundraising for different charities, you know, and I just continued when I came back. It's a wonderful, wonderful country, but there is real poverty there, and as you can imagine, with the HIV epidemic, there was a lot of orphans created by that, and you know, being able to make a contribution to improve the lives of children who've been, you know, essentially struck by lightning, you know, having their parents taken away from them, having been abandoned because parents just don't have the resources to look after them. Though, while I was in Tanzania, we raised money for, there was a convent that was looking after orphans. They do excellent work. I visited these institutions and saw the kids and saw what was being done for them, you know, in terms of basic needs. It's not just food and clothes, but it's also happiness, education, having friends, being able to be as normal as you can as a child can be under those circumstances. So I was really happy to raise money for them.
As well as dealing with adolescent health, you also got an interest in lung health, haven't you?
Yeah, so HIV, as you know, is a disease that affects many parts of the body. And one of the strongest associations with HIV that there is with TB. HIV and TB often go hand in hand, and TB is one of the most prominent lung diseases. And I was very fortunate to work with a guy called Professor Kevin Mortimer and Professor Bertie Squire, who some of your listeners will have heard on the radio. I think both of them have been on Radio Merseyside. And together we run the Impala program, which is a multi-country consortium. And this project is coming to an end this year. So for the last 4 years, we've been developing a range of research projects looking at the intersection between TB and other different kinds of lung disease. That has been phenomenally rewarding, interesting work. What was embedded in the design of the programme is a training for PhD students from a number of different African countries, and support for postdoctoral researchers. So once you've got your PhD, that's called a doctorate, and your next job are called postdoctoral researchers. So there's an investment in lung health researchers early on in the career pipeline. And I remember interviewing every single one of the PhD students. They've done some phenomenal, phenomenal work.
I think these are the latest figures I've got. They're probably much more than that. You've done 33 research works, 1541 citations, 6467 reads, 47 publications. You're an honorary consultant at La Royal here in Liverpool with clinical HIV care and so forth. You are a very, very busy woman because you're passing on your knowledge as well by teaching and by overseeing PhDs. How did you manage to do this as a single parent?
With a lot of support from my family, I have to say. I've told you about my four siblings. They have been extraordinary. My father was a brilliant, brilliant support right up until he died. They're teenagers now, which makes life a little bit easier. But it is really, really challenging trying to do all of this and make sure that you're meeting the needs of your children as well. And I think global health research is not the ideal career for somebody who's going to be a single parent, because getting childcare while you're, you know, overseas is not easy. Where I was lucky is I've had some really good childminders as well. These are things that I think the industry of research, the research sector, really has to think about, because, you know, for example, Jenny, who was our childminder for the longest time, you know, she was like a family member. And I think we need to think more creatively about how we can support women. It is still mostly women, but men as well, who have sole caring responsibilities. We want the research that we do to be relevant to the whole spectrum of populations. And so you need all sectors of the population to be represented within your research teams, you know, within the people who are, because research is about sitting down and thinking about, you know, looking at the world, seeing what the question is, you know, thinking up the why questions. Why does that happen? And the range of perspective, the broader the range of perspectives that you have amongst the group of people who are sitting down thinking up these questions, then the more representative and ultimately more impactful, I believe, your research can be. And I think the tragedy is that, and not just in global health, but across the sector, being a mother or being a parent can take a real toll on your ability to engage in research. And there's still a long way to go, I think, in terms of changing that. And being a single parent makes you're most exquisitely sensitive to those challenges.
You've called for it in papers that I've read about the inequities affecting Black and racially minoritized groups and women in academia. And that, you, as you just said, you can't get the best out of anything unless things are inclusive.
And equity is about opportunity. It's about making sure that the opportunities are there and the barriers to those opportunities are being addressed. And I think, you know, that the article that you're talking about, this is the one that was published in The Lancet last year. And there I'm talking about some of the additional weight that you carry if you belong to a minoritized ethnicity or if you're a woman, to do that labor, you know, the work of creating fairness in institutions. A lot of the time that work falls on those very same people who already are suffering from lack of opportunity. And the fact that, you know, the work is delegated to them or you know, they're expected to solve the problem actually creates a problem in itself, because, you know, it's time away from their research, for example, which is the activity that I'm recognized for, because still, unfortunately, the work of making things fairer, work to improve equality, work to improve diversity, is actually not really valued. So spending time doing that kind of thing actually can hold you back in your career. And until we change the way we value effort, we value that kind of work, things won't improve as quickly as they could do.
I know you come from a religious background, a Christian Catholic background. I just wondered how much that background has driven you through all of this.
That's a really good question. And it's a question that I reflect on. And I think, again, there are people who study religion and who know much more about this than I do. But one of the things I really valued and continue to value is some of the principles around generosity, caring for others, social responsibility that are embedded in the cultures and the teachings. And I'm sure that has informed my entire, you know, approach to life and what I want to achieve, and how the values that I want to pass on to my children. I think there are problems with, as with all religions, there are particular problems with Catholicism in terms of attitudes to women, and certainly in relation to HIV, some of the teachings around contraception that have been really problematic. Those are challenges that, as a Catholic, I find very, very frustrating. But the underlying principles of generosity and forgiveness seem to me to be really, really important. I think that, together with my upbringing by two African parents who prioritized education, who prioritized being in the world to make a difference, I think that's one of the things that my father in particular lived by. You know, he was somebody who, right up until his death, was very prominent in the Nigerian community in the UK. You know, in the way that it works for my father's generation is you have these things called age grades, where your peers, a group of peers, you meet together and you think about the world and try to make a difference. And the way I was brought up. And I think that has as much to do with how I've chosen to live as my religion. But I've chosen to send my children to Catholic schools because I want them to have some of those underlying principles just embedded in a day-to-day way, in the way that, you know, Catholic schools can do that. You know, I still remember my primary school teacher telling me the story of the Good Samaritan. And I still, from time to time, will reflect on that and think, yeah, this is how you want to be.
Dr. Angela Abassi. My second guest today is also a doctor, but not a medical one.